Hey, how's it going? It's my show. Scoville Show. Hey, Barbara Starr, CNN spokesperson posing as a CNN reporter, is talking about attacking ISIS in Syria. Let's listen.
You know, do more recruiting, get more weapons, take more territory. That's the beginning of a step, they hope. But as the Colonel Mansour says, the real issue is to, they feel, is a political one, to get those disaffected Sunni tribes, break them off from ISIS, get them back into wanting a more democratic, representative situation for themselves, and get them fighting ISIS. U.S. airstrikes can get the process started. They can be an incentive. They will not defeat ISIS. I don't think anybody believes that.
And not only that, but we've seen, you know, how ineffective it is when campaigns are short and how long the memories of are so many of these insurgents. And Colonel Mansour, to that end, would a short campaign, be it an air campaign or be it anything else inside Syria, really be any kind of solution anyway, given the fact that we've now been in Iraq for almost a decade and a half?
No, I think a short campaign inside.
All right, well, anyway, so that was the end of the reporting. Now on to the expert saying we got to stay longer, a retired colonel. All right, anyway, so, yeah, I don't know. And what a stupid question even for him. Yes, of course, a short campaign could help. Could. I'm not recommending it, but I'm just saying hypothetically. That was her question. Yes, a short campaign could help Bashar al-Assad and his army recreate a monopoly on power in the state formerly known as Syria, the eastern third of it that's now part of the caliphate. Of course. You know, they always were able to control that land until they had America and all of America's allies arming and bankrolling and training their enemies to take it from them. So, yeah, there's every reason to believe that the minority coalition dictatorship in Syria could control that land. In fact, if we just stayed out of it completely, the state army of Syria would eventually, especially with the help of Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, would/will eventually force the Islamic State out of Syria. As Barack Obama said, the idea that supporting a bunch of moderates up against a state army was pure fantasy, that was ever going to work out. And that was why he only ever did a half-assed job of it instead of could have been worse. The same is really true for ISIS. I mean, at least for now, they've got, what, maximum they've got like a 15,000-man army. And they're not really an army. They're more insurgents, just now trying to become a state. And so, you know, same old tactics, a couple of suicide attacks and swarms of guys in Toyota pickup trucks. A real army can handle that. You know, again, as I said, since the very beginning of this, since before it happened, even since a year ago, when it first happened, when the Iraqi army first left Mosul or started pulling back from Mosul and went back to Baghdad, and Patrick Coburn reported on it, and we talked about it on the show. They're aliens. They're not from there. Mosul is the country next door, basically, because the Iraqi army is just an American TV euphemism for the Badr Brigade, the biggest of the Shiite militias that George Bush dressed in American-style uniforms and called the Iraqi army. Well, so they can control Baghdad because they've got a majority Shiite population there to support them. Same for all the land all the way to Basra. But up in Mosul, it wasn't their land to hold. So that's why when ISIS came, they pulled back. You know, but if ISIS was making direct assaults against Baghdad or against Najaf or something, they wouldn't have a prayer. Because that's the Shiites' territory. But anyway, so point being that one, here they're going to get involved in Syria and continue doing an even worse job of making ISIS the enemy of the American people when they've got plenty of their own problems right now. And yet not, as the news lady was kind of correctly pointing out, they're not going to intervene enough to really make sure that Assad wins and Maliki wins and the Islamic State is smashed. even if they did, that wouldn't be the end of all of them. Certainly wouldn't be the end of all of them with Western passports. But, you know, Obama apparently at this point is committed to just making matters worse without even trying to make them better at all. You know, I mean, if he announced, I don't know, hypothetically speaking, you know, the abolition of the U.S. government, that would be best. But I don't know, what if he say, I don't know, wanted to help the FBI and the Border Patrol or the, you know, the customs people work even closer with customs officials in Europe to help keep these guys out of America, something like that. That could be, you know, a little something. But instead, all he's doing is giving these guys a reason to target America again. And in fact, where's that article I have by, yeah, here we go. Robert Fisk says, airstrikes, talk of God? Barack Obama is following the jihadists' script after James Foley beheading. The president came the nearest he has come yet to rivaling George W. Bush's gormless reaction to 9/11. I have no idea what gormless means. I'm going to have to Google search gormless. Very stupid or foolish, it says. All right, well, so that makes sense. So anyway, yeah, so Barack Obama, not just did he say, hey, we're sending, you know, white Christian Americans back to Iraq to drop bombs on you guys, but he even invokes God and God's will and says, oh, no God would approve of what you did, which makes for great shtick to the Americans. But what he's really doing, as Robert Fisk points out, is he's presuming to tell these guys, not just the beheaders, but anybody who are their even possible would-be supporters, that he gets to be the judge of their God. And that, you know, his is bigger and better than theirs. They know he's not a secret Muslim. He's a Christian. And what's hilarious, of course, is these guys are all monotheists, quibbling about lower-ranking gods on the chain, lower-ranking prophets and messiahs and what have you. But anyway, so Barack Obama comes out with Osama's script and reads it and says, it's my God versus your God. It's us lighter-skinned North Americans versus you Arabs. And here we go again. They also, Barbara Starr on CNN was talking about, yep, the policy is we got to recreate the Sunni awakening. And we got to turn all the tribes against Al-Qaeda. Well, it only worked temporarily last time. And yes, it's true, America has supported the bad guys in Syria all along. The worst guys, for sure, yeah. In Syria all this time. So they have had quite a boost. America and America's sock puppet allies for the last 3 years there. They have had a boost, but still, there's no reason to believe that this intervention is going to... Oh, I forgot what the hell I was going to say. Oh, it's going to do anything other than put the American brand name back on the intervention. Meanwhile, ISIS is surrounded by enemies. America's now just signing up with them. Instead of staying out when the staying out is good, we're just signing up with Iran. We're just signing up with Assad. Not that I'm saying I think they are the enemies of America, but they are the Shiites in what America has created there, a Sunni-Shia civil war. And so it does no good for us to join them and make those matters worse. Just stay out. Whatever consequences flow from here, the market of power over there has got to sift. And these people who are saying, oh, well, the ISIS, they're fanatical like Nazis, they've got to be stopped, and they've got to be stopped by us before they succeed. You know, that was Bill Kristol's criticism of Obama's. Obama said, well, these people like these always fail, which was a hint that maybe he didn't want to do all the overthrowing himself. But you know what? Obama's in the right as far as arguing with Bill Kristol on that. If only he acted like he talked, that, you know, the truth is the, I don't know if it'll be the tribal systems, but ultimately the people that ISIS is trying to rule will overthrow them. because they really suck. It's the same thing that's happened to them over and over again.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I got Thomas Mountain coming up. We had technical difficulties because he lives in Eritrea. And that's the land of technical difficulties in the Horn of Africa region there. But we're going to follow up with him because he wasn't done telling us about Somalia and about South Sudan and all kinds of things. So you're going to hear from Thomas Mountain again on the show today. And I got a few more invites out. I don't know. I was trying to find Chris Hellman, but I can't get a hold of him. I couldn't figure out his correct contact info anymore. All of my numbers and email addresses all bounce and are over. But Chris Hellman, he's from the National Priorities Project, and he's the guy who, as of a few years ago now, calculated that $8 trillion had been blown on the national security state since September 11th. You have no idea how much money that really is. Neither do I. It's so much money. I mean, if you have a PhD in mathematics or whatever, then I guess I concede to you. But the rest of us, we don't even know how much money that is. It's so much money. Oh, my God. Anyway, that was a few years ago. And they've been spending more than $1 trillion a year since. But I lost count of how many years ago that was. So I thought instead of simply Googling it, I would try to get Chris Hellman back on the show. And then he could give us the update. What's the total number of trillions of dollars that they've blown on all this killing and all of this militarization and all the spying and all the destruction of everything that was ever good about America? How much has it cost? In dollar numbers? In hours at the unemployment office? Anyway, I was trying to get a hold of Chris Hellman. I'm going to keep working on that, in fact. I'm going to not give up. I'm going to try to get Chris Hellman back on the show. Also, I have a couple of Iraq experts I'm trying to reach. Dar and, well, I don't want to tell you the other one. Because that would be good luck if I can get them, you know, and try to keep that going on. Yeah. All right. So now I got a bunch of ISIS news, and I got Gaza, and I got Afghanistan and Ukraine and Libya and Ferguson news. Lots of Ferguson news. So, but let me get back to ISIS here for a bit. The caliphate, the Islamic State. Oh, wait, there's Dar in my email. Where's my cursor? I got too many computers on one cursor here. How about one? Oh, Pacific. One. Let me be two there, three there. Nope, too late. Dang. Too late. 12:30 p? Huh? How about that? All right, trying to get Dar on. All right, so I saw a thing, but it was, and it made a good point. But it had a lot of kooky stuff in it, too, so I didn't really know what to make of it, and I kind of, sort of shrugged. I talked with Eric Garris about it and said, isn't that kind of fishy and funny? I don't know. And that is the footage of the beheading of James Foley. When the guy grabs him by the chin, I don't know if you saw it on Live Leak, it's pretty horrible. He puts the knife to his throat, but then there's no blood. And then it fades to black, but it looks kind of funny, you know? And okay, Dar on the show tomorrow. So, but anyway, but the guy was, you know, the post that pointed that out that I read just went on and on with like, oh, it was probably shot on a set in Nevada and God knows what. So yeah, all right. Well, you know, I don't know. So I talked to Eric Garris about it. It's kind of funny looking. On the other hand, his parents have spoken and they don't seem to be doubtful whether the still shot of their son's head decapitated and resting on his own back lying prone on the ground, of his body lying prone on the ground, whether that was real or not. Somebody shows you a still photograph of your own son with his head cut off, you know whether it's really him or not. Come on. They're not confused about that. I talked with Mitchell Prothero. He said, yeah, all his friends who knew this guy better than he did. He said he knew him, you know, had met him a couple times or whatever, but he has a lot of friends and colleagues who knew him. They're all devastated by this. They're all real-ass war reporters. They've all seen this footage, and they knew this guy. They said that's a picture of his decapitated head, then it must be. But still, it's an interesting question. Where's the blood from the cut on the throat and this and that? Well, Eric Margolies wrote an article where I think, you know, he could have been a little more careful with his language. But he said, you know, it remains to be seen whether this is real or not. And well, it turns out he had a good reason to be suspicious, because there's a new article today from, oh, what the hell? Man, I really should have had my link ready to go, huh? Let me see if I can find the link here. Oh yeah, here, I've got this conversation going on. The link is to news.com.au, which is, I think, the Australian News Corp Australia, and they're linking to the London Times. And the London Times has talked to a forensic science company which has worked for police forces across Britain. And they say there is no question that the man was beheaded, but that camera trickery and post-production techniques look to have been used. I think it has been staged, said one expert, after he was commissioned by the UK Times to examine the footage. My feeling is that the execution may have happened after the camera was stopped. And then they go on to talk about the inconsistencies. They say the knife was drawn across the neck area at least 6 times, and there's no sign of blood. Secondly, and this is, well, I'm no expert, so I would put less on this, but maybe this is relevant too. The sounds he allegedly made do not appear consistent with what may be expected. I guess it depends on your experience with such videos. And no incision can be seen on his neck, though the right hand of the jihadist partially blocked the shot, it says. But anyway, it's pretty easy to speculate that, you know, they just killed him and maybe cut his head off after he was dead, which would have been a bit of a kindness, I guess, if you're going to cut somebody's head off to kill him first or something. But anyway, isn't that strange? I don't think there's a mystery as to whether the man is dead or not, just as these people are saying here. But it does seem that the part of the clip where they actually take the knife, the guy actually takes the knife to his throat, was faked. And I wonder about that. A fake knife? You used a fake knife with a dull edge? Yeah, I don't know. Interesting footnote here. That's all I got to say. It's news.com.au. You can also read it at the Times of London there. All right, and then, yeah, I don't really have any lessons from that or anything other than, you know, I guess these Islamic State guys, they sure are politicians, man. Already, they've gone from insurgent to politicians. Out come the lies along with their brutality. I wonder, though, if maybe that was, like, part of the deal. He'd read the script if they promised to just shoot him and spare him the worst form of death there or something. I don't know. It sounds crazy, but, you know, the al-Nusra Front, they kidnapped David Enders and let him go at one point. This other guy was let go yesterday by the al-Nusra Front. That's not the exact same as ISIS, but they're suicide bomber, prisoner beheader crazies, too. And yet sometimes they don't, so I don't know. Anyway, that was a whole segment? Sorry, we'll be back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, then. Oh, you know what? I forgot this one. For those of you who, a couple of you guys asked for the list of bumper music I play
I don't think I put this one on the list. It's discharge, free speech for the dumb. I like those guys. They're funny guys. All right. So listen, I got a couple of main categories of ISIS news to cover for you today. One of them is the news. And there's so much of it. I mean, god dang, but it's got to wait. Because first we got to talk about a little bit of history here. And there are two great articles along the lines of historical history and the Syrian / Iraqi war going on right now. First of all, it's Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com/Justin. ISIS, made in Washington, Riyadh, and Tel Aviv. That's right. And then also very interesting, a little bit beside the point I want to make now, but I really hope that you'll read it. It's about a 7,000-word, very long, very in-depth, a very well-done piece by a guy named Walid Farwana. And I follow him on Twitter, and he's a... he's a soon-to-be official expert on this stuff. I don't know if he is or not. I think maybe he's a graduate student. Anyway, he's really good, and it's called The History of the Islamic State, and this is about the consequences of American intervention in Iraq in 2003 and the rise of Zarqawi from the invasion on, and the rise of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then through the awakening, and then on through into the Syrian civil war, and the split with al-Nusra, and all the way through. It's just really great. It'll really help to inform your perspective. It's The History of the Islamic State by Walid Farwana, today at antiwar.com. But anyway, back to Justin's point here, which is the same one I'm making here, is that the reason that America has supported the Mujahideen in Syria ever since 2011, has worked with the Saudis, with the Qataris, the Kuwaitis, the Turks, the Jordanians, to support the rebels, to support civil war in Syria, is because that's what Israel wants. Because the Likud Party government of Israel hates the Ba'ath Party government of Syria and would rather be rid of them. And I think it's crazy. And you might think it's crazy too, but it's still true that they would prefer a permanent state of war with various groups of suicide bomber brigades going up against each other. I guess their ultimate dream would be pure, you know, ISIS or al-Qaeda versus Hezbollah forever in Syria if they could get it. Even though, as I often joke, Assad might as well be Mossad. He might as well be a secret agent of the Israelis. This whole time, he's made nary a peep about the Golan Heights. He's basically just about stability. They don't have a peace treaty with him. He's no Hosni Mubarak, you know, outright loyal sock puppet. I am being facetious. I'm not saying that I think he really is. But I'm saying he might as well be, because he is a secular minority coalition dictator who's got a country to try to hold together. And in other words, is up to his eyeballs in his own problems. And so they're crazy to think that it would be better for them to have a bunch of basically bin Ladenites running around up there in Syria instead. And yet that is their policy. And you can read Barack Obama explaining to Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic in 2012. That's right, man. The reason that America is supporting this rebellion in Syria is because we're trying to take Iran down a peg. If we can get Assad out of there and a new government, that'll be a serious blow against Iran. And then he jokes, I could tell you more, Jeffrey Goldberg, about what we're doing, but then I'd have to kill you. He doesn't say it exactly like that, but he makes one of those jokes about, I can't tell you everything we're doing because it's classified, blah, blah, blah. But it's all about Iran. And then you can read it over and over again, and here Justin has the footnotes. He got them from somewhere. Michael Oren, bluntly stating, I play this clip for you over and over at the Aspen Institute thing in a talk again with Corporal Goldberg from The Atlantic, saying that in any struggle between the Sunni jihadists and their Iranian Shiite enemies, the former are the lesser evil. And not really their Iranian Shiite enemies. The Ba'athists and Hezbollah, who are the Syrian Ba'athists, who are backed by Iran. So it's not quite the same thing. But to Michael Oren, it certainly is. And Michael Oren, that's the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, says that the al-Qaeda guys are the lesser evil. Why? He says, we always wanted Bashar Assad to go. We always preferred the bad guys who weren't backed by Iran to the bad guys who were backed by Iran. Simple as that. There it is. Here's also Seema Shine, Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs. 1 year ago said, the alternative whereby Assad falls and jihadists flock to Syria is not good. Which is what's going on right now. We have no good options in Syria. But Assad remaining along with the Iranians is worse. His ouster would exert immense pressure on Iran. So, yes, it's true also. That the Saudis, of course, hate Assad and want to get rid of him. And they hate the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, for years, you can go back and see, unfortunately, Google's not with the technology now where they can search my MP3s for text. In a few years, that'll be out. And boy, is that going to prove how right I was about everything. But anyway, you could go back for years, probably 10 years, since I first read The Clean Break, or, you know, 2004 or something. I have asked my expert guests rhetorically, and if they do get rid of Assad, replace him with who? The Muslim Brotherhood, if they're lucky. Right? You've probably, if you're a long-time listener to the show, you've heard me say that for 10 years. Now, that's the neocon policy, huh? Regime change in Syria, huh? And replace the Ba'athist secularists with who? The Muslim Brotherhood, if you're lucky? Are you crazy? That's me quoting myself for years and years on end here before any of this Arab Spring and intervention nonsense ever started at all. And so anyway, here they are. They're perfectly happy to admit it. And here's this also this New York Times piece where it's by Judy Ruderin, September the 5th, 2013, almost a year ago. Israel backs limited strikes against Syria. This is when Obama and the Israel lobby were the only ones pushing for war with Assad on behalf of al-Qaeda last year. And it says here, more quietly, Israelis have increasingly argued that the best outcome for Syria's 2.5-year-old civil war, at least for the moment, is no outcome. For Jerusalem, the status quo, horrific as it may be from a humanitarian perspective, seems preferable to either a victory by Assad's government and his Iranian backers, or a strengthening of rebel groups increasingly dominated by Sunni jihadis. This is a playoff situation in which you need both teams to lose, but at least you don't want one to win. We'll settle for a tie, said Alon Pincus, a former Israeli consul general in New York. Quote, let them both bleed, hemorrhage to death. That's the strategic thinking here. As long as this lingers, there's no real threat from Syria. And so that is why Hillary Clinton continued, you know, despite even Obama's reluctance, to push and push, and then when she finally resigned after the end of the first term, she put it in the New York Times that I tried to get Obama to arm the rebels more, and he wouldn't do it. Now here she is, again, telling Corporal Goldberg in The Atlantic just last week, 2 weeks ago, that I wanted to back the rebels, the moderate rebels, more, but Obama wouldn't do it, so then ISIS filled the vacuum, which is, of course, a lie. Obama and Hillary backed the rebels some enough to create the vacuum to remove Assad's state army from eastern and northern Syria, where then ISIS filled the vacuum. They created a vacuum but filled it with nothing, but they didn't have anything to fill it with. As Obama said in pushing back against Hillary, the idea you're going to create some moderate force that really could overthrow Assad and defeat the jihadis is fantasy, he said. But there you go. This is why America supported Saudi and Qatar and Turkey and Jordan. And the CIA has helped arrange all these weapons and arms shipments this whole time. Because that's what Israel wants, is for America to support al-Qaeda and ISIS, even worse. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And, continuing along that same theme there about the Islamic State, I've been pointing out since the fall of Mosul that it's actually ironic that because of the treason, lowercase t treason, but sorta. Their support for the jihadists in Syria, that's real treason. What I was going to say is more lowercase t. Because Israel wants this treasonous policy towards Syria, that's why Washington, D.C. supports it. Oh, Assad's a bad guy? Yeah, Assad's a bad guy. Yeah, let's get rid of Assad. Hey, you know what the Israelis want us to do and say and think? Got to get rid of Assad. And it's because of that narrative, that's what's prevented full-scale war against the Islamic State so far. You realize that? That's finally coming undone. So it's ironic that the narrative is so confused as to who's the bad guy in Syria. Is it Assad or is it the rebels? Now, they're doing everything they can to promote this, woulda, coulda, shoulda, supported the moderates enough to make a difference nonsense, which is actually even being debunked in the Washington Post and is not really considered true. That's considered the fringe position. The Hillary Clinton position is considered more and more kind of the yeah, right position. But really, all that's left is for D.C. to forgive itself for siding with al-Qaeda against Assad, because that's what Israel wanted for all this time. And that's fine. It's not like anybody is going to be held accountable for it whatsoever at all. But now that they can kind of use the, wish we'd supported the moderates, and maybe there's a little bit of an argument about whether we should have supported the moderates more, blah, 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 blah. Now that that is kind of used to smooth over and confuse the issue a little bit during the transition here, now they're switching back to Assad. George W. Bush, of course, used to pay Bashar al-Assad, and Bill Clinton before him, to torture and kill jihadis for the United States. As Bob Baer, the CNN expert and former CIA guy, has been quoted as saying before, if you wanted somebody to be tortured, you sent them to Assad in Syria. If you wanted them to disappear forever, you sent them to Mubarak in Egypt. And then, I guess because they just feed them to the pigs, bones and all, or what, I don't know. But anyway, that's a longstanding policy of rendition of all kinds of jihadis from all around the world to Syria and to Egypt to be disposed of for 20 years. So now that we're switching back to that policy again, for now, then that means there's very little standing in the way of, I don't know, them making it 1,000 times worse. Because right now what they're doing, and you can't help it, doesn't matter who you say you're in there to protect, there's a new story now. Oh, what about the Turkmen? Are they the new Yazidis? Well, of course they are. Hey, what about the Sunnis? The Sunnis are only 20% of Iraq. They're a minority too. And they're the ones who are most directly affected by the rise of the Islamic State right now. Well, there's a minority we've got to go and protect. What about them? The Sunni Arabs. And the Kurds, and the Turkmen, and the Yazidis. And are there any Chaldean or Maronite Christians left at all? Or they've all been obliterated off of the face of the earth? Last I heard, there were 8 Jews left in Baghdad. There had been hundreds and hundreds before the invasion in 2003. What about the Druze? Are there any Druze left in Iraq? Maybe we have to invade to protect the Druze. They'll just keep coming up with excuses why they got to intervene. But what are they really doing? What are they really doing? Again, they're fighting for Iran and revolutionary Shiism in the world. There are no good guys' sides to take here. And in taking the side of Iran, which I'm not saying is an enemy of the United States of America, because it's really and truly not, but in taking their side against the Sunni, uprising, basically, in Iraq, we just make their enemies our enemies that much worse. And they already did this. They did this from 2003 through 2006. They fought for all the Shiite parties, the United Iraqi Alliance, kicked all the Sunnis out of Baghdad, made it an 85% Shiite Arab city, fought a whole civil war for the Supreme Islamic Council, the Dawa Party, the Sadrists, the sock puppets, especially the former two there, the sock puppets of the Iranians. Then, at the same time, they never stopped backing them, but at the same time, they started bribing the Sunni tribes to turn against the al-Qaeda guys at the end of 2006 and through 2007 to marginalize them. And so I guess here they want to try that again. See if that can work. But at the same time, they're going to be backing Assad and backing Iran and backing the Shiite government, backing the Bada Brigade, backing the whichever Shiite militia massacred all those Sunnis praying in Diyala province last week. How is that supposed to work? It's a political solution. We need a political solution. Everyone put your sectarianism aside. Baghdad, use your oil money. Shiites, use your oil money to bribe all the Sunni tribes into turning on the Islamic State. That's the plan. And yet at the same time, America is intervening. And intervening on the side of Iran. And in that way, delegitimizing the government in Baghdad. That many more factors of 10 or 1,000 or whatever. Right when they're supposed to be doing this compromising is right when America signs right up for the Quds Force. That's some great foreign policy you got there. And, you know, Raimondo in his article today at antiwar.com talks about the redirection, right? Where in 2005, really, this starts with Zalmay Khalilzad in 2005. He's the first guy, 2 years into the war in Iraq, he's the first guy in power to say, hey guys, we really screwed up and fought this war for Iran. So now we got to change our mind. Now we got to switch back to the Sunnis. Now he wanted to do that before they were finished giving Baghdad to the Shiites. And they didn't. They told them to shut up. And they basically, you know, picked up the Khalilzad policy a couple of years later. Francis Biddle wrote about it for the Council on Foreign Relations as like the, you know, intellectual cover for it. And no, I don't know if it's the same Biddle family as the old Jackson versus the Bank. That's, I don't know. But anyway, Biddle's pivot is what Justin Raimondo called it then. Seymour Hersh wrote an article called The Redirection. And The Redirection said basically, well, we're switching back to the Shiites. I mean, pardon me, back to the Sunnis, back to the Saudi Arabian tribe and what they want. And what they want is, you know, their Cold War against Iran. It turns out the Sunni-based insurgency America had been fighting all along, the American army had been fighting all along in Iraq while fighting on the side of the Shiites, had been backed by the Saudis, just like ISIS is backed by them now. Now we're redirecting toward them. And as Hersh reported then, that meant they were backing Fatah al-Islam, which was an al-Qaeda-like group in Lebanon, and they were backing Friends of the Muslim Brotherhood and other Sunni Islamist groups in Syria. This is back in 07. Go read it. The Redirection by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker. And then also backing Jandala in eastern Iran, in Baluchistan, and backing PJAK in Kurdistan, which is the Iranian faction of the PKK, basically. And that, of course, is all about turning back against Iran after doing them the greatest favor in the entire world by carrying out Ariel Sharon and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle's plan for Iraq. Oops. They decided they would try to turn back the other way. But then look how far they pushed it. They pushed it so far. And in fact, Coburn, Patrick Coburn's been writing a ton of things lately. But one of the things he says at The Independent is that he talked to an American policymaker a year ago, or maybe it was 2 years ago in 2012, about, you know, everyone I talked to in Iraq says that the civil war in Syria and the support for the rebels in Syria is making their problems tougher in Iraq and is blowing back on them and is energizing. That was his term he always used on this show. Is energizing the Sunni-based insurgency again in Iraq, right when Maliki's doing everything he can to piss them off, too. And the Americans told him, we're not worried about that. We've looked at it, and we've decided that we're not very concerned about whether the war in Syria blows back into Iraq. That's not going to happen. And yeah, boy, you guys sure are sure of yourselves. So, Scott, in the Sunni-Shia-Arab civil war going on that George W. Bush started back in 2003, whose side is America on now? All of them. Still. I don't know. I could see why you might think that they're really just trying to get as many Arabs killed as possible, but I mean, they could just drop atom bombs on them. If that was really their goal, they could be a lot more ruthless about it, but it sure does kind of seem like it will end up being the result anyway. And this could go on for generations. Once they gave Baghdad to the Shiites, that guaranteed this is going on for generations, man. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm here. You're here. Hey, join up the chat room, guys. Got a discussion going on in there today. Pretty good, looks like. Starting to be. ScottHorton.org/chat. ScottHorton.org/chat. Coming up, Thomas Mountain is going to be on the show to talk about American intervention in Africa. And assuming we don't have the same stupid telephone problems again, we're going to learn a whole lot of stuff from him. I like Thomas Mountain, that guy. I mean, I don't agree with him on everything, but he sure does have a chip on his shoulder in the very best way against the American Empire and what it's up to. And so, I like that. Thomas Mountain, he's going to be on here in just a few. Tomorrow on the show, Dar Jamail and also MJ Rosenberg. And, damn, okay, well, let me see. I don't want to switch to Israel stuff yet, because I won't be able to stop. So that's going to have to wait until a little bit later in the show, I guess. But let me just mention at least this thing in the New Yorker. The entire article is worth a read. It's probably 5,000 words or something, but it's worth the read. It's called Friends of Israel. The lobbying group AIPAC has consistently fought the Obama administration on policy. Is it now losing influence? I don't think the answer to that question is really yes. Only in a very long-term kind of sense, maybe. But it doesn't matter, because what's important about the story isn't the point of the story. It's all the reporting that is in it. And no, it's not written by a libertarian or a, you know, anti-Israel hard-ass or anything like that. But it is, you know, in-depth. It raises a lot of concerns in my mind when I read it, if you know what I mean. In fact, I should have been taking notes. I'm going to try to get Connie Brooke on the show, but really I don't care if I can get her on the show, because I'm going to talk with MJ about it. He's quoted in it, our old friend MJ Rosenberg. Former AIPAC staffer from a long time ago. MJ is a harsh critic of Israeli policy now. And anyway, he's quoted here. But man, there's a lot to learn about. It's really infuriating, man. It makes me angry. And most of it is simply because, you know, I don't have billions of dollars. If I had billions of dollars, one of the things that I would do is I would bankroll movements just like this by people who don't want to support Israel. And that's what this story is ultimately. And yes, there is a lot of illegality in there. And Grant F. Smith has written book after book about it and done interview after interview about it. It's not just playing the game of democracy. But damn, they play the game of democracy so well. I mean, you know, even AIPAC itself doesn't donate. There's a quote in here from Orrin Hatch saying, "You just play a silent bass drum, but all your constituents can hear you and know what you want them to do." And then what happens is they just get everybody who's a AIPAC fellow traveler in the country, or who are members of actual PACs that have been set up by AIPAC, to all donate exactly as they would. And so they really can blackball. It's not 100% foolproof, but they really can blackball the hell out of a congressman or make one. And they do it over and over again. And they've just got a better handle on how to work the U.S. Congress than any other lobby probably ever, other than, you know, banking and the military-industrial complex. But, you know, I don't know, even then. I mean, in the middle of a war, they get 100% unanimous support votes in the Senate, this kind of madness. Anyway, read this article, would you? It's good. It's called Are American Jews Turning Against AIPAC? Well, that's what it says in the top title, but that's actually not what it's called. It's called Friends of Israel. Well, they have a different title in the top bar of my browser than they have down below. Friends of Israel. The lobbying group AIPAC has consistently fought the Obama administration. See what happened? I started talking about Israel. I couldn't shut up about it. God dang it, Bobby. MJ is going to be on the show tomorrow. I'm getting back to the Israel stuff. It's just, well, here's another one. This IDF spokesman has threatened Rania Kalik. Are you familiar with her, the Palestinian journalist? She is talking about, you know, equivalence between the Gaza Strip and the Warsaw Ghetto. And I forget where the original quote comes from, but the original quote is, the Gaza Strip in no way resembles a ghetto. What? So she's tweeting an Israeli apologist's, you know, ridiculous denial of the truth of, you know, the reality of the Gaza Strip situation there. And after she tweets that out, check it out. Captain Ronnie Kaplan of the IDF tweets her back, Rania Kalik, and says perhaps something may be done against journalists using Holocaust to delegitimize existence of Israel, like you, dot, dot, which I think means dot, 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 meaning wait and find out. Wow, really, huh? I wonder what he thinks can be done about Rania Kalik saying, hey, look, everyone, if you know anything about the Warsaw Ghetto, then you can make a pretty easy comparison to the Gaza Strip, except that the Gaza Strip isn't in Poland, but otherwise it's pretty much the same deal. What are you going to do to her about that, Mr. IDF spokesman? Are you kidding me? Western democracy in the Middle East? Sounds like a Middle Eastern theocracy in the Middle East to me. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. Damn. All right. Oh, man. See, there's something. Yeah. Well, I guess I should just stick with Israel for the rest of this segment. I'm getting back to the Islamic State in a minute. Israel vows escalation of Gaza war after child killed in shelling. Israeli child died in mortar attack. Israeli officials are inconsolable and vowing dramatic escalation of the Gaza war following the death of 4-year-old Daniel Tregerman in mortar fire from the Strip. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. We are intensifying our attacks and preparing for possible ground action, noted Brigadier General Mahdi Almaz. General Mahdi, huh? Huh. Israel ended its previous invasion of Gaza over a week ago, but with peace talks faltering, seems to be looking for a way back in. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu ordered the attacks to intensify and said that Hamas would pay a heavy price for the death of the child, which brings the overall Israeli total to 68, four of them civilians, and Tregerman the first child. On the Gaza side, Israel's attacks today brought the death toll, and this is actually 3 days old here, guys, sorry, but an important one, brought the death toll in excess of 2,100, with the vast majority of them civilians and roughly 500 of them children under the age of 18. Israel appeared, and I don't know what the breakdown is of, you know, under 12, but it's substantial anyway. Israel appeared, not that a 13-year-old is fair game or anything, but for some reason, you know how it is. Under 12 is even more especially innocent than that. Israel appeared to be moving toward a new ground invasion before the latest death, calling up 10,000 more reservists yesterday to keep large numbers of troops along the Gaza border in anticipation of a new ground operation. And then, have you guys seen the footage? Go to news.antiwar.com and look at this. Israel leveling Gaza apartment blocks, other large buildings. And I guess they gave notice, which supposedly makes it okay, but what it really does is it doesn't make it okay, but it does give the Palestinians time to set up a camera to record the footage. Israelis is leveling high-rise apartment complexes. You look at the footage, I mean, man, I don't know. It's really something else. They're shooting high-rise apartment complexes with missiles and injuring, and I don't know if they killed any, but I saw there were at least people wounded in the first one. At least four now have been razed to the ground. The largest building, a 13-story apartment block, had 43 different units. Israel claimed Hamas was using one of the apartment units as a command center. At least 17 people were wounded in that attack. Oh, there you go. And then, now, I guess there's not independent corroboration, but there is a story, and it's in the New York Times even today, not a very good piece, but a credible story of this Palestinian kid being abducted and used as a human shield, which you ought to read about. Not proven, but I wouldn't say too doubtful either. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So I guess you've seen, I mean, I don't really know, but as far as I can tell, this is a giant thing in popular culture right now, is billionaires and famous people are having buckets of ice water poured on their head, including George W. Bush, reminding everyone what a torturer he is. But it's to raise money for ALS, which I don't know anything about, but I guess is some horrible genetic disorder that makes people suffer. And so Bill Gates and I don't know who all, a bunch of people have poured water on themselves. And apparently it's such a big deal, the Gazans decided that instead of doing the ice bucket challenge, they would launch the rubble bucket challenge to call attention to the strife there. In fact, I better make sure and hit follow on her. Dalia Azat. Let's see who she is. Middle East follower. I don't know. Doesn't say. Doesn't matter. Great picture of one Gazan with a bucket of rubble pouring it on another Gazan's head. It's their rubble bucket challenge to try to get you to care at all for a minute about the Gazans. And, well, let me say two more things about that. Yeah, it's on my Twitter feed if you want to look at it. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Great pick there. Couple of things while I got your attention. Rubble bucket challenge. You should know, in case you don't know, for everybody who does know, obviously you know this. But for everyone who doesn't know, you don't know this. But you need to know that there's an occupation going on. That Gaza and the West Bank were conquered back in 1967. So it's not the country next door or the territory next door or the anything next door. They are not the neighbors of the Israelis. They basically live in ghettos within Israel. Israel has de facto annexed the West Bank and the Gaza Strip for 45 years. But the Palestinians, most of them, are hemmed in to Gaza and the West Bank, and they live under martial law, under totalitarianism. At best, you could say, as Noam Shizof, the Israeli writer, puts it, I put it in Slate.com, he said, well, you could compare the West Bank to a minimum security prison, perhaps, and the Gaza Strip as a maximum security prison. But anyway, if you listen to American media, especially if you know what you know about Israel-Palestine from listening to the radio or just from listening to kind of, you know, hear tell and word of mouth and this and that, you would get the idea that this is some kind of a match between equals. Or if Israel whoops them, still, that's what you get for picking a fight with the neighboring state that's more powerful than you and that kind of thing. That would be the impression that you would get. And the truth is that, no, they're occupied. And the law, since the end of World War II, so-called law, can only be enforced if America, the superpower, enforces it. So if America gives them immunity, then they got it, don't they? It's not much of a law. But the law, since Hitler, has been you're not allowed to, even after you defeat the country next door in a war, even if they start it, you're not allowed to occupy their country and settle your people on it and take it and conquer it. No more Lebensraum, not for anybody. Of course, they'll support secession in some cases, but no more conquering neighbors. That's the war crime now. You can whoop them, but eventually you got to withdraw, or you got to come to some kind of settlement, you got to obey some kind of law. You can't just move all your people in there and take it. But that's what they do anyway. And so the Palestinians are just resisting that. All this stuff about, oh, they started it by firing rockets is just a stupid lie. It's just not even anywhere near true. The entire blockade of the Gaza Strip is an act of war. If any other country did what Israel does to Gaza, to the United States, we would nuke them with hydrogen bombs, okay? It would be an act of war. If they imprisoned us, even between California and Maine, if we weren't allowed to leave, we weren't allowed to fish off our own shore, we weren't allowed to trade, we weren't allowed to have air travel. If anyone tried to do that to us, it would be an act of war. Well, it's the same thing when the Israelis do it to their prisoners in the Gaza Strip. An unrelenting siege where the Israelis are caught in their own documents and out loud and in the Chelsea Manning liberated State Department cables at WikiLeaks and everything, counting calories for their victims in Palestine. Keeping them under siege. That is an act of war already. Keeping them in a maximum security prison where the mean age or the median age in Gaza is under 18. That's according to the CIA fact book, but that's who everyone cites. I tried to look for better, different sources on census data from Gaza. I think that's the best anyone has. That's who the UN cites. They cite the CIA fact book on it. But so that's the official story. Is that half of them are kids? You wonder why there's 500 dead kids in this war. It's because they're everywhere. Because that's who are the prisoners of the Gaza Strip. The whole thing is basically a juvenile prison. And Hamas aren't even the prison guards. Hamas are just the strongest gang in the prison. The IDF are the prison guards. And it's not just that there's children everywhere. It's also the Dalia Doctrine, which is a doctrine of collective punishment. Again, here revealed in the WikiLeaks. IDF regional commanders speak out in press interviews is the subject. This is from October of 2008. And it's about they have a name for it. It's did I put an L in it? It's the Dahiya Doctrine. Dahiya, Dahiya Doctrine. And what it is it's kill civilians. Make them suffer, and then they will change their politics and do what we want, right? Just like the Iraqi people rose up and overthrew Saddam because that was why Bill Clinton, that was the excuse he used to starve them with his blockade in the 1990s, right? Oh, wait, no, that never did happen? Oh, okay. They just all starved and died anyway? Oh, okay. Eisenkot labeled any Israeli response, this is the State Department writing here, Eisenkot labeled any Israeli response to resume conflict the Dahiya Doctrine in reference to the level Dahiya quarter in Beirut during the Second Lebanon War in 2006. He said Israel will use disproportionate force upon any village that fires upon Israel, causing great damage and destruction, right? So the Haditha massacre as policy. As policy. Eisenkot made very clear, this is not a recommendation, but an already approved plan. From the Israeli perspective, these are, quote, not civilian villages. They are military bases. Yeah, see, that's all you have to do is lie. Pretend you believe a thing that you know is not true, and then you can do whatever you want. How insightful. More than 2,100 dead so far. Oh no, but we only do pinprick precision attacks. Hey, all Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back.
I don't think I put that one on the list either, did I? What is that? It's Turbo Negro, armed and fairly well equipped. That belongs on the list too. All right, and listen, we got our guest Thomas Mountain on the line, but just real quick, I couldn't find the footnote while I was talking. I was clicking everywhere. It was the other damn browser. Here it is from the New York Times from 2 days ago. From the New York Times. Quote, Brigadier General Mahdi Almaz, the chief Israeli army spokesman. Oh, again, General Mahdi. Every citizen in the Gaza Strip who has in proximity to him or his home weaponry, we view him to be a legitimate target, General Almaz said. There you go. That's that. Go ahead and kill civilians in order to change their politics policy. That's called terrorism when a non-state actor does it. Just so that we're clear here. Unbelievable. Anyway, so on the line we have our friend Thomas Mountain, and he writes for Counterpunch. And we had him on last week, and then we had telephone difficulties. He writes from Eritrea in Eastern Africa, and unfortunately, we lost the phone call, and we're unable to finish the interview, but now's our chance to follow up, and with a whole bonus segment, too. So right on. Welcome back to the show. Thomas, how are you?
Good to be back.
Good, good. Very happy to have you here. Now, so I lost you right when we were coming back from break last week, and the question at the time was, I was hoping that you could fill me in about the Amoros, I think is how you say it, from the Ogaden region of Ethiopia, because, you know, we had talked about how when the famine hit in 2011, especially, how the Somalis were hit hardest of all because of the American war there had turned the whole society upside down. So the famine was just hitting them on top of that. And you mentioned about in the Ogaden region how they had But you were saying how they had suffered just as bad because there was a civil war going on in Ethiopia where the Ethiopia wasn't just fighting the Somalis at the time. They were, continually persecuting the Amoros and disrupting their civilization so bad that they were suffering the same problem as the Somalis, not just the unrelenting heat and drought, but also the complete disruption of their markets and their ability to trade and feed each other.
Well, the Ogaden region is actually populated by the Somali people, but they don't consider themselves part of Somalia. They consider themselves an independent region called the Ogaden. Next door to the west, in the south, is the Oromo people, which actually make up at least half of some 40 million Ethiopians.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. So I'm sorry. I had my regions and ethnic groups wrong there. Please, thank you for clarifying.
Well, the Oromos actually were suffering from the drought, too. Not all of them, but the ones in the south were suffering from the drought. But this is the worst drought in 60 years. And the Oromos have been in the news more recently, because there's been a big, there was an explosion amongst the Oromos because the Ethiopian regime had been taking their land and turning it over to foreign investors and carrying out a lot of nasty policies against the Oromos as well. But the Ogaden is where the armed struggle has been pretty unrelenting now. It came in the news in 2007 when the Chinese tried to come in and drill for oil and natural gas in the Ogaden National Liberation Front, which is the rebels fighting the Ethiopian regime, warned the Chinese off. The Chinese didn't listen, and they attacked the Chinese drilling outfit and killed about 12 Chinese and as well as several hundred Ethiopian guards. So at that point, the Ethiopian government went crazy because Ethiopia imports all of their fuel, and it, by some accounts, up to 75% of their foreign currency goes to pay for their fuel needs. But they could get some fuel, natural gas or oil coming out of the Ogaden, which is reported to be quite rich in energy resources. then that could solve their problem or go a long way towards solving their problem. And when the Ogaden fighters put a stop to that, the Ethiopian government clamped a complete food and aid, a medical aid embargo on the region and started carrying out a scorched earth policy. And so fast forward to the 2011-2012 drought, the worst drought and famine in 60 years, the Ethiopian government had even kicked the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders. Now, what country in the world we know of has kicked out both the Red Cross and Doctors Without Borders in the midst of the worst famine and drought in 60 years? And yet, nothing was said in the West. I mean, the fact is, Enough Project, headed by someone I call Obama's quiet consigliere, Gail Smith, a very quiet senior member of the White House intelligence staff, was head of in opposition to the Bush regime at the time, and it founded this organization called Enough Project, today headed by John Prendergast. And they had actually written about the scorched earth policies of the Ethiopian regime in the Ogaden. And then, of course, when Obama came to power and she became a senior member of the Obama administration, Enough Project shut up completely about this Ogaden genocide. Now, when I say genocide, actually, I'm not the one that really, I'm not the only one that's labeled them this. The International Federation of Jurists has called it a genocide and called in the International Criminal Court to prosecute the Ethiopian regime for carrying out a genocide during the worst, by applying this food and medical aid embargo on the region during the worst drought and famine in 60 years. So, but see, the thing is, whenever we talk about the East Africa, the Horn of Africa, whenever there's a major problem, you can just about guarantee the Ethiopian regime is behind it. And I mentioned briefly last time about how the problems in South Sudan are based in Addis Ababa, that this Riek Machar, who is the so-called rebel chief, is actually being supported by the Ethiopian regime. And because Ethiopia is a client state of the United States, and the United States wants to see China kicked out of Sudan, the Sudanese oil fields, which is the only Chinese-owned and controlled oil fields in Africa. The United States gets about half of its imported oil from Africa, and it's in the U.S. national interest to deny access to African oil and energy to the Chinese. And the Sudanese oil fields is Chinese's only major majority-owned involvement there. The United States wants China out. The only beneficiary of this horrible civil war is going on in South Sudan, with its thousands of innocents being massacred, this huge famine resulting as coming about right now as I speak, because the people have been driven off their land and have no food because they couldn't plant in the rainy season, is the only beneficiary is the United States. And the United States policemen, the one that's their thug that does the dirty work for the U.S. in the region, is the Ethiopian regime, which has been carrying out a genocide in the Ogaden and now is involved in Sudan, in South Sudan. And it's called an open secret out here. I've interviewed a number of diplomats from Uganda and Kenya. The chief of staff of the Eritrean government has come out and said, this is an open secret. Ethiopia is behind this war in South Sudan. Mm. Everybody looks at Africans killing Africans when it's actually the United States. The United States wants to get rid of the South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir, because he continues to work with the Chinese and continues to support the Chinese in their attempts to reopen the oil fields in Sudan. The United States wants to get rid of him, and they want to install their boy Riek Machar. And Riek Machar is not new to all these massacres. Way back in 1991, he was carrying out big massacres. And I recently saw an Al Jazeera interview from 3 or 4 years ago where they asked Riek Machar about the 1991 massacres he carried out, and he, in the exact same words that he's using today to deny involvement in the massacres in South Sudan. So this is a huge problem that we're having here in the Horn of Africa, where Ethiopia was the one that destroyed the Union of Islamic Courts peace initiative that brought peace to the Mogadishu for the first time in 15 years. Now it's Ethiopia that's brought civil war to South Sudan. Ethiopia didn't invade Eritrea in 2000. I mean, there's this huge enemy of the people of Africa that's centered in Addis Ababa, and yet we have that former prime minister of Ethiopia, the guy that launched this genocidal aid and medical embargo on the Ogaden, Mela Sanare. When he passed away, who's eulogizing him?
Susan Rice. All right, now hold it right there, Thomas. We got to take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Thomas Mountain after this. Check him out at counterpunch.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. Of course, I'm on the Liberty Radio Network at libertyradionetwork.com, LRN.FM. Talking with Thomas Mountain from Eritrea. Well, he's an American in Eritrea. And we're talking about America's support for all kinds of death and destruction across East Africa and at the hands of our sock puppet proxies in Ethiopia. There are a few different things I wanted to follow up on you. Thomas, first of all, in South Sudan, I know that for years and years, America supported the South in the civil war there. And it was, more than a decade, it's been on the record in, you know, the New York Times version of history and everything, that the South is where the oil is. And it's also where the black Christians and animists are. And so you could conceivably, you know, you can use that as a pretext to break it off from the rest of Sudan, which is Arab and Muslim, and call it a new state. And then, as you said, to keep China out or keep that oil either off the market or pumping this way if it gets going anywhere. But now, so you're talking about a further level of intervention since the successful secession of South Sudan from the rest of Sudan. Now there's a civil war that's broken out. And according to, you know, the NPR version of the story, it's a tribal difficulty. And I don't know if it's the majority or the minority who supposedly control the capital and the rest want to share power. And so now it's a big civil war within the new state. And what you're telling me is no, because the Ethiopians, at the behest of the Americans, are backing one side against the other. So can you talk about the Minka men and the different tribes and who's on whose side and how exactly this works a little bit for us, please?
Sure. Just a little bit of background. The man that's considered the founding father of South Sudan is a John Garang. And John Garang, interestingly enough, was vehemently opposed to the independence of South Sudan. Way back in 2005, John Garang, when he first, after the peace deal was signed, between the Bashir government and the South Sudanese People's Liberation, South Sudan People's Liberation Movement, headed by John Garang, he came to his Khartoum and spoke in front of a crowd of over a million people. And President Bashir, the biggest crowd he ever pulled was about 100,000. John Garang spoke to over a million people. And what did he say? He said that he was against South Sudanese independence. He said that we're going to have one Sudan, there was equal rights and justice for all Sudanese with John Garang as the president. He was going to running for president in the next election. And also he said they were going to have an independent foreign policy and they weren't going to work with the Western exploitation regimes. They were going to work with the Chinese and come in and try to set up some sort of partnership with the Chinese and develop an independent economy. And within just a matter of weeks, John Garang was dead. So John Garang, the father of independent South Sudan, was actually against South Sudanese independence. So that should tell you that there were storm clouds that gathered over South Sudan before it was even born. Mm-hmm. And then I had an article predicting all the present outbreak of violence 2 years ago when I said that the U.S. plan to destabilize Sudan, when I wrote about how the United States wanted the Chinese out and how the United States was going to foment a crisis in the country. But they managed the South Sudanese and the Sudanese managed to patch things back up, get the oil, Chinese oil flowing again. And then we had this so-called coup led by Riek Machar, who's from a minority tribe called the Nuer. And the president of South Sudan is from the majority, the majority tribe called the Dinka, and his name is Salva Kiir. Salva Kiir was the head of the military under John Garang that fought against the Bashir government. And he became, after John Garang's mysterious death, he became the new president of South Sudan. Well, when they finally have independence. So you have you know, the conflict is based among ethnic groups. But the question is, the reports coming out now that tens of millions of dollars worth of weapons are pouring into South Sudan. And where are those weapons coming from? Who's paying for all that? The oil fields are shut down. How is Riek Machar's army and his ethnic-based army paying their bills? How is he getting ammunition? Where is he getting the money from? See, that's the question that's not being... Show me the money. The question is not being asked. Okay, where is this funding coming from? So it's become an open secret. The Ethiopians are supporting him. Now, like I mentioned, Ethiopia has an ongoing energy crisis. They're hemorrhaging foreign currency to pay for their fuel import. Now, the Brazilians have promised to build a railroad from Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, to the western border in Gambela, where there's large amounts of oil, underground oil. And the Gambela fields are linked into the South Sudanese fields geologically, and you can transport oil via railroad cars. And if the Ethiopians are able to come in and get a hold of the South the Sudanese oil, then they could solve this major problem. And so they have their own axe to grind in this conflict. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the United States is paying something like $3 billion a year in aid to Ethiopia. I mean, Ethiopia, it's a well-kept secret. Ethiopia is the most aid-dependent country in the world. Ethiopia's export bill last year was something like, I mean, they had about $2.1 or $2.2 billion coming in exports for a country of 80 million people. And the import bill was over $11 billion. It was something like $9 billion a year. Nobody explains where that money's coming from. It's keeping the Ethiopian regime afloat.
Well, not only that, but keeping them in occupation as they've reinvaded Somalia and are occupying Somalia, which is costing $1 zillion a day. Obviously, it's the American taxpayer that's picking up that's pushing the tab for all of this, whether we know it or not. That's really something else. And my apologies, here in my ignorance. I got fooled by the headline here. Minkamin is a place, of course, in South Sudan. I know nothing about it. So it's the Nuer and the Dinka are the groups that are fighting. But as you're saying, and when, which side is it that's backed by the Ethiopians, or they're just trying to destabilize the whole situation?
Riek Machar is from the Nuer tribe. And historically, the Nuer and the Dinka have been at each other's throats. Back in 91, Riek Machar led a Nuer massacre of a lot of Dinkas. The Nuers live around the oil fields along the border, the Abyei region, along the border between North and South Sudan.
All right. And,
okay, we're still there. Okay, I thought we got cut off.
Oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
Something other interesting people don't realize, the extent the United States is actually trying to, it's not just divide and rule, it's actually a crisis management. The United States prefers to create crisis and then manage these crises to better loot and plunder the resources of the area. The United States doesn't want to see African countries cooperating and working together, and I'll give you a prime example. Ethiopia is building a giant new dam called the Renaissance Millennium Dam that's going to dam up the historic waters of the Nile River, and it's threatening Egypt's very survival, because as that dam fills up, Egypt's going to lose 20 or 30% of their water, which they need desperately to keep their country afloat. I mean, just to feed the country, let alone create electricity to keep the people alive. So now this dam is going to produce 6,000 megawatts of electricity. Well, right presently, 75% of Ethiopia, 60 million people, have no electricity. So there's no budget to bring electricity to these people. And yet this big dam's being built, with 6,000 megawatt dam, and by estimates, is the most Ethiopia could use, even if they put electricity in for the 60 million people that don't have it, would be 2,000 megawatts. So why is Ethiopia building a big dam, blocking off the Nile River, creating a conflict with Egypt? Egypt's going to launch a war against Ethiopia if this dam goes into effect. And Ethiopia doesn't even need the electricity. They only can use a third of the electricity being generated. Well, lo and behold, who was the ones that started the brainchild of this dam? Was the World Bank, 51% owned by the USA. So now the USA has got two of their client states, Ethiopia and Egypt, even though Egypt may be less and less of a client state these days, at each other's throats, threatening war, rather than working together and developing economic partnership and developing independence and self-sustainability apart from Western economic domination.
Right.
So, we every time we turn around and we see a problem, who's behind the problem? Who's actually the one that pushed this brainchild that pushed the creation of this dam in the first place, a dam that Ethiopia could, the electrical needs of Ethiopia could easily be met by smaller dams on tributaries to the Nile and not threaten Egypt's access to that water.
Yeah,
and
that's what they did in Sri Lanka.
All the water and electricity they need.
Yeah, that's the same thing they did in Sri Lanka in the book By Way of Deception. There's a big IMF boondoggle and just served to split the population and set them at war. Make a bunch of money in that case for the Israelis. I don't know if they're in on this one or not, but same old scam, it sounds like.
Well, you know, that's the thing. So, you know, when I tell people anything you read, don't trust anything you read about the Horn of Africa and almost nothing you see, you know, that whenever you take a deep look at what's really going on in the Horn of Africa and the conflicts that are going on, the major conflicts, inevitably you see a foreign hand in all of this. And then you want to blame Africans for being savages that are just incapable of living together in peace, and, you know, it's just tribal violence and bloodshed, and it's all just big chaos and famine and war, and this is just, it's just inherent to the black savages in Africa. Well, you know what? There's somebody behind all of this, and I think that's something I really have come to appreciate the Scott Horton show, because he's one of the very few voices out there that's willing to have this sort of a viewpoint put out there. And I want to tell all your listeners out there, you guys, you got to, you know, dig deep in these hard times and donate to the Scott Horton show, because otherwise there's these huge crimes that are going on about that we're just not going to hear. And I got to say this, even though it may sound a bit harsh, in the middle of the summer of 2011, as the worst drought and famine in Somalia and the Horn of Africa was beginning to rage, and hundreds of people were dying every day in the outskirts of Mogadishu, an award-winning journalist named Jeremy Scahill landed in Mogadishu and the result of which he wrote a groundbreaking expose about not the famine that was taking hundreds of lives a day, ended up taking 250,000 lives. He wrote about the drone program and the assassination drone program and a supposedly secret CIA prison there. And, you know, whether it was intentional or not, and I don't know how he missed the fact that within a few miles of the hotel he was staying, hundreds of people were dying every day from a Western-imposed famine. You know, we had a smokescreen that pointed everybody off into this drone where, you know, hundreds of people were assassinated by the drone program. The fact is that at least 250,000 Somalis died, and maybe a couple hundred thousand Somalis in the Ogaden died, and not a mention of this in anything. So, you know, the Scott Horton show is about one of the few places that you're actually going to hear about this on the radio, and your listeners have got to get behind Scott, because I know life must be tough for independent journalists like you.
Well, you know, at the time, I actually was talking with Leslie Lefkow from Human Rights Watch, and she was doing great work on the famine there. And, you know, I'll give Jeremy credit, because I think he does the best job of any Western reporter so far of putting in a nutshell in his article, Blowback in Somalia. He's got maybe one or two big paragraphs where he really goes point by point by point. This is how America intervened and escalated and escalated and escalated and escalated. And you're right that it's like a mortal sin, the omission, apparently by ignorance, of the famine that was taking place at the time. But on the other hand, he really does tell the story about how whatever's going on there is America's fault pretty damn well, too. So, and in fact, on page 222 of his book, he quotes the State Department goon saying, "Oh, we wanted to keep Sheikh Sharif all along anyway. We just wanted to take him down a peg." Yeah, that's why they killed 250,000 people in this horrible war and led to the rise of al-Shabaab, madmen and all the rest of this. It was because they wanted to take Sheikh Sharif down a peg or two. They didn't even want to get rid of him. So, I mean, that to me is the ultimate indictment. They ought to all be doing 1,000 years in prison for that.
We had an earlier smokescreen. It was called the Darfur Genocide. And
right.
See, the Darfur Genocide was something that was created by mainly pro-Israel Zionist organizations in the West, and it raised at least $100 million, claiming to help the victims of the Darfur Genocide. And I haven't been able to find any evidence that any of that money, that $100 million, ever made it to anybody in Darfur. But the fact was, the fighting in Darfur took place mainly in 2003, 2004. By the time, maybe 20 or 30,000 people died, a real tragedy, but no genocide. By the time these Western pro-Zionist, pro-Israel organizations started raising the hue and cry of the Darfur Genocide, the fighting had already over. And yet they demonized the president of Sudan, was actually credited by all the UN staffers from Darfur that I've ever spoken to with being playing an active role in actually preventing mass starvation. If it wasn't for the cooperation and support of Omar al-Bashir that the most successful relief project in history, which was the largest, most successful relief project in history, which is the Darfur relief effort, would not have been possible. All along in Ethiopia, the real genocide was going on. Mm-hmm. And who was covering all this up? Well, you know, takes us back to the Obama White House. We've got people like Gail Smith. Now, have you ever heard of Gail Smith?
Only from you.
Yeah, again, if you Google her name on the internet, you come up with she's a senior foreign policy advisor to Obama on Africa and foreign aid. And she, Tony Lake, and Susan Rice were senior foreign policy advisors to Obama in his campaign. And the payoff to Anthony Lake was he got head of UNICEF, the failed nominee to head of the CIA, became head of the organization of the world. And Susan Rice went on to become ambassador to the UN and then now national security advisor to Obama. But Gail Smith is the quiet consigliere. Mm-hmm. And she's the one that's behind the scenes. She's the senior advisor to Obama. She's the big sister to Susan Rice. Susan Rice's actual godmother, really, literally godmother, was Madeleine Albright. But her big sister that guided her from her days in the Clinton administration as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs was Gail Smith, who went from a career as a supposedly award-winning journalist in the Horn of Africa, who actually lived in the trenches with the Marxist-Leninist Enver Hoxhaite Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, which is now the ruling party in Ethiopia, and was actually the mistress of one of their fighters, named guerrilla fighters, Dom Deguerra's name was Jamaica. I mean, she was so down in the trenches that she won the admiration of her at the top levels of the U.S. intelligence community. That in 1991, she was given an award as a journalist, and 3 years later, in 1994, she became the chief of staff of the Agency for International Development. Now, how do you go from being a journalist in 3 years to being head of the chief operating officer of the largest U.S. multi-billion-dollar aid agency, Agency for International Development, which has actually just recently been in the spotlight because they were trying to destabilize the Cuban government through their AIDS awareness program in Cuba. So she, the 3 years from a journalist to head of USAID, I mean, that should give you an idea that this woman she caught the attention of the top members of the U.S. Intelligence Community. And by 1998, 4 years later, she was the head of the African desk for the National Security Council under Bill Clinton and under Tony Lake. So this woman today now sits in the White House, just down the hall from Obama. And before Obama does anything, he calls Gail Smith in and says, my consigliere, what should we do about these problems in Africa? Or my consigliere, what should we do about these foreign aid programs we're going to use to destabilize countries around the world? And this woman, nobody's ever heard of. And, I've been overdue to write an article about her because she's someone that nobody knows about, and yet she's a darling of the liberal establishment. Yeah. When she was, after her time in the trenches with the Clinton administration, she went after, I think it's a Center for American Progress or something like that. I mean, she was a darling of the liberal society, and now she's back in the White House, one of those that was little pushers behind the scenes for this big disaster in Libya. The one that knows full well because the organization spoke about the genocide in Ogaden when she was in opposition to the Bush regime. Mm-hmm. And now she's doing her best to raise smoke screens and other things, try to keep anybody from talking about the real genocide that's going on in Ethiopia. So, I think that's something your listeners ought to look into. It's interesting that her personal biographical information and how she went from a journalist to being head of a chief of staff of USAID in 3 years is no longer available on her website.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, when I Googled her, I'm really falling down on the job here, Thomas. I Googled her. It says here her official title is Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director of the National Security Council. So, I should know everything about this lady and what she's up to, not just her background, but what she's up to. I will note that it's hilarious that her latest blog entry is from January 2013, and it's about more humanitarian aid for the Syrian rebels.
Well, this woman got up at Melisenali's funeral and eulogized him and talked about him. And I saw this on Ethiopian TV, which we have on satellite here. and via satellite. And she got up and talked about how she'd been good friends with Mahmoud Sanawi for over 30 years. Now we're talking about going back in the early 1980s, you know, back when Mahmoud Sanawi was a guerrilla fighter off in the trenches of the Sahel Desert fighting the Soviet-backed Derg regime of Mengistu Haile Mariam. And so she's like, you know, good bosom buddies eulogizing this Mahmoud Sanawi that's committing genocide in the Ogaden and sitting right next to Barack Obama, who is son of an African from Kenya. So, you know, I had an article a few years back. You can start with that. I think it's called From Guerrilla Mistress to Obama Confidant, The Life and Crimes of Gail Smith. And I'm about to come out with another one that's called Obama's Quiet Consigliere, and how this woman that eulogized, I mean, she's praised, effluent praise of Mahmoud Sanawi at his funeral. She and Susan Rice were both there sitting in the front row praising one of the worst dictators Africa's ever known. And, you know, this is the liberal establishment in the United States, you know, that drives so much of us progressive and revolutionary forces to close alliances with libertarians because the liberals can't be trusted. And I mean, when I say liberals can't be trusted, I have to include at times even people like who do such good work as Amy Goodman, because Democracy Now! Went on and on about the Darfur genocide, and I've never heard of them ever doing a program about the genocide in the Ogaden. So, you know, it's like, I don't trust liberals.
If this is what the revolutionaries are like when they take power, just DLC, Hillary Clinton Democrats, that's pretty damn dangerous. I wanted to ask you, too, real quick here, Thomas, about the new dictator of Ethiopia ever since Zanawi died there. Who is he and how bad is he?
Yeah, well, he is like a flunky that had no... Mahmoud Sanawi handpicked a guy, Haile Mariam Desalegn, because he was no threat. He had no basis in power, and he could provide no threat. And Mahmoud Sanawi picked him shortly after the United States dumped Mubarak. And Mubarak was a loyal servant to the United States policy for all those decades. And Mahmoud Sanawi saw how quickly the United States disposed of him. So with Mahmoud Sanawi, apparently he was sick. He had a brain tumor. And he knew that his time was up, and he knew that the United States might want to get rid of him. So he set up as his deputy, somebody nobody had ever heard of, had a master's degree in public sanitation from someplace. And he became, now he's the new prime minister of Ethiopia. And he's sort of like a compromise candidate because the pack of hyenas that Mahmoud Sanawi is surrounded by, who was his former comrade in arms in the guerrilla movement called the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the ethnic group that Mahmoud Sanawi is from, one of the smallest, most despised ethnic groups in Ethiopia, but who succeeded to power after the Eritrean army, guerrilla army overthrew the Soviet-backed Mengistu regime in 1991, now these Tigrayan hyenas, that each of them want to have power, and like a any pack of hyenas, if one hyena runs in to take a bite of Haile Mariam Desalegn, the other hyenas will bite him from the back. So they sort of have a compromised candidate that they're letting sort of be the front man while they sort of circle and see who's going to be the chief hyena that eventually wants to come to power. But see, the reality is the situation in Ethiopia is so unstable that the United States has had to step in. And this is something I really was with hope that the latest Snowden revelations would expose more, because we'd heard in the WikiLeaks revelations that how the United States has been involved in a lot of scandalous activities in support of the Ethiopians, or are fully aware of crimes the Ethiopians are committing, and they're blaming the Eritreans and others for. Because what I wanted to know was, you know, the role of the CIA in Ethiopia, because I've had an article based upon reports that many of the high-ranking Ethiopian officials have been complaining about the fact that they can't make any decisions without consulting the white man down the hall in the CIA office, and that the CIA has basically been setting a lot of policy in Ethiopia. And the fact is, see, there's been a series of high-level assassinations of leading members of the Ethiopian resistance, whether they're in the new Tigrayan resistance or among the Ogaden fighters. There's been some very disastrous assassinations, not just of key leaders, but oftentimes majority of the central committee of these resistance organizations. And, you know, something that ought to give people pause about what's going on in South Sudan is that recently Ban Ki-moon, the head of the UN, nominated the former head of the Ethiopian military intelligence to head the South Sudanese quote-unquote peacekeepers of the UN. And this general formerly had been head of the 10,000-man Ethiopian quote-unquote peacekeepers that had been occupying the oil fields in on the border between North and South Sudan. These Ethiopian peacekeepers who have been so blatant about arming the rebels of Riek Machar that UN staff even held a press conference last year to denounce the destabilizing acts of the Ethiopian peacekeepers in Sudan, which should have tipped everybody off that Ethiopia was behind Riek Machar, but somehow everybody even missed all that. So the head of the Ethiopian, former head of Ethiopian military intelligence, is now head of so-called peacekeepers in South Sudan. And this is the guy that was assassination death squads that was going out and killing the people in the resistance movement.
All right, and oh man, I'm sorry, I got a beeping on the line here. It's not supposed to be like that, but it is. And you know, you've had clicking on your line this whole time too. Maybe it's not a thing, maybe it is, but anyway. Well, you know, I've kept you way over time here, and the phone bill is going to completely bankrupt me, man. I better stop it now, Thomas.
Hey, man, your listeners got to come through. Your listeners got to come through, Scott. Great to be back on the show, man.
Thank
and
you,
we'll
Thomas.
See you again someday.
I sure appreciate it.
Okay,
very much.
Ciao.
All right. That's Thomas Mountain, everybody, reporting from Eritrea. And he writes for counterpunch.org. That's where you can find him most often. And you'll be able to find the entire thing. I record him all the way through that 9-minute top of the hour break there. Because, I didn't want to stop him. And he had a lot of stuff to say, and I had more questions to ask him. And so later on, you'll be able to hear that whole thing at scotthorton.org/interviews. Sign up for the podcast feed. I should say that all the time. There's two different podcast feeds. There's the whole show archives, and there's the interview archives. Go to scotthorton.org/show or scotthorton.org/interviews, and you can sign up for them there. And, yeah, there you go. And, you know, what I should do sometime is I should be better prepared, obviously. And I should interview Thomas Mountain, and then I should interview Nick Turse back to back. And Nick Turse can explain how what you just heard Mountain say about America's policy in East Africa applies for basically all of Africa. The invasion is on. And there's an average of a mission a day that they admit to. And, of course, most of it, not the missions. I mean, missions are missions. Most of what they're doing over there is training up local sock puppet armies. You know, for future use. And, Phil in the email is absolutely right. It's like Confessions of an Economic Hitman on steroids. That's what it is. You know, G.R. Griffin talks about this in The Creature from Jekyll Island. I read back in high school about, the IMF and the World Bank gangsterism. How it's so easy to bribe a local kleptocrat to sell his people out, to put them on the hook for everything, for loans that they couldn't possibly pay back, so that then all their collateral is forfeit and the whole game is simply just stealing. And then, you know, the kleptocrat gets to move to Switzerland and everything's fine for him and all his people suffer. And then eventually the debt gets rolled over onto the American people anyway. But, you know, the local peasants have to suffer long enough for the billionaires to get what they're stealing. And, of course, as you can find on YouTube, maybe I'll try to find this for you during the break. There's some kind of seminar held by the leaders of AFRICOM where they talk about one of their major purposes is trying to keep China out of African oil fields. Full spectrum dominance. Benevolent global hegemony, you see. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, Yeah, lots of unbelievable things going on, believable as they are. Check it out, man. Tony Blair is busted here writing a memo to Nursultan Nazarbayev, the dictator of Kazakhstan, telling him, hey, when you give a speech, you should refer to a massacre of 14 protesters as tragic, though the deaths were. They should not obscure the enormous progress the country is making. Because, you know, that's good shtick after you murder 14 innocent civilian protesters. Yes, it's true, but enormous progress. And it says here in the Telegraph, Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of Great Britain, is paid millions of dollars a year to be a lobbyist and a PR man for the dictatorship in Kazakhstan, where they boil dissidents alive to death. Oh, yeah. Oh, you think I'm making that up? Check it out. Fat Craig Murray, the UK's former ambassador. Oh, no, I'm talking about Uzbekistan, aren't I? Kazakhstan's different. It's Akiyev who boils the guys alive. Oops, wrong Stan. I better fix my tweet. Oops, wrong Stan. That was Kazakhstan. Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, so I get lots of stuff wrong all the time. At least I fix it in real time. Figure out my own mistake before you gotta call me on it, right? That's pretty. Oh no. Oh no. See, I screwed that up too. That was Uzbekistan. I shouldn't tweet while I'm talking on the radio. I should just shut up. Or I should just talk. Coming up on the show, interesting things to say. Ferguson, let's talk about how Hillary Clinton, cornered by reporters, refused to comment on Ferguson. And you know as well as I do, without being told by me, what's going on through her mind. Here's Hillary Clinton's mind. Who is it better to offend? Poor black people or middle class and upper middle class whites who might tend to support the cops? And what about the police unions? The executive branch has got to know that they can count on their leadership, you know? And that's all she calculated. If she comes out on the side of the innocent poor black guy here, well, that could hurt her support. Remember the saving grace, almost, of her presidential candidacy were those white middle-class Pennsylvania voters who decided, eh, she's Republican enough for them, they guess. And she's worried that if she says, actually, no, it's probably not right for cops to just execute unarmed black men, and maybe it's not advisable to bring out the army in the form of the sheriff's department to crack down on anyone who dare raise a peep about it. Because she wants unlimited power. And so everything that she does and says is a calculation for how best to achieve unlimited power for herself. And so all the cops and all the unarmed black guys can all burn in hell as far as Hillary Clinton cares. But who can be most useful for getting done what she needs done? I can hear the pollsters now. Hillary, black people already decided they like Bill, but they don't like you. So forget them. Our numbers here say, no, it's those Western Pennsylvanian white folk. That's who you're really relying on, Hillary. Don't want to cross them. Although, I don't know, did anybody do a poll of those people and really ask them if they think it's all right? I know, the Pew Charitable Trust said they did a poll. White people actually like militarization, as long as it's directed against blacks, so
I don't know. She made the right call from an unlimited power at any cost point of view. But, you know, Hillary Clinton is a lot like Israel. She kind of, she only sees that short-term kind of gain, but always lacking in the big picture. And so, I don't know, I think this plays into her image of the kind of lady who doesn't care at all about powerless, poor black people. And how, overall, that's not a very good image for a nice lady running for president to have. Geez, Hillary, why do you hate black people so much? You can't bring yourself to comment on the murder of Mike Brown. Really? Sort of like, hey, Israel, I know you keep crying that you're the poor innocent victim, but, you know, you kind of wore it out three or four of these aggressive wars ago. And now everybody thinks you're a jerk and a liar about everything. So anyway, you know, that's just my own professional public relations point of view. Hey, Hillary, you ought to pretend to care about the powerless a little bit sometimes. Hey, Israel, you murdered tiny helpless children too much. You see, that's my public relations firm. That's my pitch for my qualifications for Tony Blair's job. I'll tell you how you can kill protesters and get away with it. Just cite enormous progress. We've made enormous progress in sending paramilitary SWAT teams out like standing armies to murder powerless, politically powerless, poor black people in America. We've made enormous progress, you see. Just ask Tony Blair, that's all you need to say. And everyone will politely applaud. They'll call it liberalism. Something. Someone called me a liberal this morning. I wondered, compared to what? But I don't know. Anyway. Yeah, Hillary Clinton. She doesn't care about black people at all. Of course. Look, you know as well as I do. She doesn't care about anyone except herself. Hillary is nothing but ambition with blonde hair. That's it. And glasses. Even the glasses are probably part of her, you know, focus group tested thing, right? Lord knows she changed her hair 10 million times based on what she thinks you want to see. But, you know, I don't know, contacts or glasses, that's a matter for the experts. You know, down at the PR firm to decide. Yeah, boy, she's going to be a horrible president, man. She's going to be like George W. Bush bad. She's going to be like Barack Obama bad. Worse, maybe. Not that I prefer Jeb.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys. Man, Ian sure picked weird places to begin some of those clips, man. That's all right, I guess. That sounds funny, that one, doesn't it? All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, scotthorton.org. scotthorton.org/chat. If you want to join up the chat room during the show, got half an hour left here. scotthorton.org/chat. Follow me on Twitter, @ScottHortonShow. Send me tweets. Retweet me. Retweet me. @ScottHortonShow. And, yeah. So, to recap, lots of important stuff. First of all, go to antiwar.com. Okay. Also, second of all, go to antiwar.com and look at Justin Raimondo's column, ISIS, Made in Washington, Riyadh, and Tel Aviv. Not comprehensive, but yeah, I put a lot of links in there to a lot of stuff that you could look at.
I probably overdid it with the New York Times, but I did it along the lines of even the New York Times admitting that this is true kind of a thing, rather than, you know, anyway, so you understand. ISIS, made in Washington, Riyadh, and Tel Aviv. Click those links. Lots of footnotes for you there. And then also the history of the Islamic State. And he does not so much get into American support for the rebels. I mean, clearly he mentions it and is not ignoring it. It's just that he's kind of writing a whole different story here, which is about how America invaded Iraq. And then America backed not just the Shiites, but the most sectarian factions of the Shiites. The most Iranian-backed sectarian factions of the Shiites, because they were the ones who needed us the most, and the gamble was that they'll keep needing us, maybe, hopefully. Nope. Turned out all they need is Iran and their own majority, and then control of the land from Baghdad to Basra, so they told Bush and Obama to beat it, and they did. After getting Iran's dirty work done there. And, I know, I'm such a broken record on that issue, but kind of a big deal. Starting with the invasion, the overthrow of Saddam, not just did they fight a civil war for the Shia, they created the conditions of a civil war for the Sunnis. And then he talks about the competing interests of the Iraqi Sunni tribes and the Islamists, and how the tribes leverage the Americans and vice versa against the Islamists and marginalize them for a time. But then how, of course, the Syrian war and American and allied support for the Sunni-based insurgency in Syria has helped re-energize the whole damn thing again, and et cetera. And yeah, it's long. It'll take you a little while to read. It's, you know, not that long. It's 7,000 words or something, I'm guessing. It's called The History of the Islamic State by Walid Farwana. And so it's about, you know, from 2003 and Zarqawi and then his rise and the Al-Qaeda in Iraq and then his death and then the Awakening and the Syrian War and all through the dang history. It's really good. You should read it and it'll make your brain smart. And then there's a good Ron Paul about Ferguson there at antiwar.com today too. And well, and Jason Ditz is just ripping it up at news.antiwar.com. He's got all your most horrible news coverage, which brings me back to the situation in the Islamic State again. Well, I think I mentioned pretty much. Oh, here's one more footnote from the earlier conversation. You know, the hard breaks interrupt sometimes. This is from November 22nd, interesting date, 2011, Obama aide, National Security Advisor Tom Donilon says, end of, hey, why did my computer just crash? Hey, God dang it, Bobby, that is bad timing. Well, what he said was, you can find it in Haaretz. What he said was that, and this is the earliest quote I know of the Obama administration being this official about it, that a blow to Assad, the weakening or regime change of Assad in Syria would be a severe blow to the Iranians, right? So even though Iran is not our enemy, and the Al-Qaeda guys are, oh well, we're going to support the Al-Qaeda guys against the Iranians' friends. Crazy. I wonder if my computer's going to restart at all, or if that's it, it's just dead, or what? Well, thankfully, the computer that's talking to you guys is still running, but the one that I was reading off of is dead and gone. It sure looks like. Oh, these things happen. Boy, I hope that hard drive isn't completely cooked or something. I should get a can of air and clean that thing out. All right, anyway, that makes it hard for me to read the news, I guess. I can go from the top of my head. Mitchell Prothero, writing from Irrible, has talked about one car bomb attack in Irbil, apparently an Islamic State. Remember the last time I talked to Mitchell on Friday, I said, hey, what about, okay, obviously they can't do a frontal assault into Irbil, but can they sneak in and then do suicide attacks, that kind of thing? And he was saying, sure, we'll be hard-pressed to. Well, blam, there you go.
Islamic State attack inside Erbil, and then more important and just along, what was the rest of his answer? The rest of his answer was, I'm much more concerned about Kirkuk. And then, blam, his article comes out, suicide, or at least car bombing in Erbil, and then multiple, I believe it was three, suicide car attacks in Kirkuk. And there's still a lot of Arabs in Kirkuk, and so it'll be easier for Islamic State forces to infiltrate in there and cause absolute havoc and blowback against the local Arab population and God knows what. So, so it's just really starting. I forget how many hundreds and hundreds of miles. It's almost 1,000 miles. Maybe it's more than 1,000 miles. I think it's like 800 or 900 miles of border between the Caliphate and Kurdistan as of right now. And the Peshmerga just can't keep that border. And it depends, of course, just how far the Islamic State wants to push. I think these lines are, and depending on the amount of American intervention, the lines are pretty much staying where they're at, I think. The Islamic State has filled up the vacuum and called it a state. They're surrounded by enemies, and that doesn't mean the war will be short. The war could last for a long, long time. But as long as the Islamic State exists anyway, I don't think the lines are going to change very much from the way they are now. I guess it depends on what all happens in the province directly to the east and northeast of Baghdad and Diyala province. There's some other mixed provinces. In fact, Sunnistan reaches down into the south. The Caliphate reaches down into the south of Baghdad, kind of around Baghdad and a little bit of a crescent there. So that probably just portends further sectarian cleansing by the Shiite militias there. The lines don't have to change by very many miles to mean a hell of a lot of dead people. But now, you know, the U.S. government is openly talking about switching back to Assad and beginning airstrikes in Syria because they have to admit that, well, look, they admit that airstrikes are no way to really dislodge the Islamic State anyway, but then especially, yes, it's ludicrous if they can all just go back across the former border into Syria and be safe, then that doesn't make any sense. That's like, you know, the Ho Chi Minh Trail cutting into Cambodia as a safe haven from their point of view, and they're not going to allow that. That's even worse than that. I mean, the capital of the Islamic State really is in Raqqa more than Mosul, or maybe a little bit of both there, but... So here they are, and Assad is saying, listen, I want to be your valuable partner in the war against terrorism and whatever, which, of course, what do you expect him to do? It's the only saving grace he's got. And again, enough of the nonsense about backing the moderates. I follow this one kook from the Brookings Institution. I forget his name. Anyway. All these guys forever harping on, oh, but you could be supporting the moderates. You could be supporting the moderates. Well, look, when jihadis went to go and join the war against Assad in 2011, 12, 13, these weren't the average Iraqis who were the natural response to American occupation. They were the jihadis. They were the Al-Qaeda in Iraq guys. They always were the whole time. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. Great. Well, my computer's cooked. I tried to restart it, and it blowed up again. It's not supposed to do that, right? It's supposed to keep going. I needed that for computing things later, too, is my problem. God dang thing. You know, literally, I'm having flashbacks of all the computers I've loved before. Many of them. And the trauma they put me through. Oh, boy. Well, what am I going to do? It's still only 2014, so computers that don't blow up on me all the time are still in the future. Hopefully, my backup things have been backing up correctly and backing up stuff. I would like that. Simpsons is on.
Huh, what's going on? Shouldn't you be at work?
I am at work. This is what I do. But keep it moving, Marge. This isn't a parking lot.
I'm sorry.
Well, anyway. Yeah, I've been watching a lot of Simpsons. Now Jason Ditz has been reporting at news.antiwar.com that America has been giving targeting information to Assad by way of the Germans. That's how they reestablished contact there. And so BND is the middleman there in bringing Assad back into the war on terror fold, such as it is. Hey, we can just switch back and forth between Eurasia and East Asia, the Sunni and the Shia and whoever, back and forth forever. Think of all the money to be made in coffin sales and condolence cards and Lockheed products. I pick on Lockheed because they're the worst in the whole world. But also there's General Dynamics, of course, and Raytheon and SIAC, and, you know, who knows? There's endless numbers of gigantic corporations that exist to do nothing but suck off the American taxpayer, like ticks, and create weapons for our and everyone else on Earth's enslavement. They're really bad guys. So they're going to do well. We can just do this thing forever and ever and ever. There will always be Salafists with rifles to point at and fight. And believe me, with these ISIS guys, there's always going to be atrocities to point at. Holy crap, look at the insanely murderous Gestapo-like thing that they did to these people. Yep. They're going to keep doing it too. And America's not going to stop that. All America's going to do is match it and then raise you some. As Margulies put it in his recent article. Oh yeah, no bombing people from the air. That's just fine. That's clinical. That's precision. That's like a scalpel. burning people to death. Blasting their bodies to little bitty pieces, or maybe even just to dust, to nothing, with high explosives. That's a clean way of killing somebody, not barbaric type behavior like beheadings. Even though, of course, George Bush famously ordered Kofor Black to cut bin Laden's head off and bring it back to him. I bet you $1,000 bin Laden's head is in the crypt at Yale right now. I bet you $1,000 it is. Even though Barack Obama is the one who got him. I guarantee you. I wonder if they have it in the main room for the freshmen, or you gotta be for the new guys, or you gotta be a patriarch already to... That could leak out, man. Everybody knows about Geronimo, you know? Anyway. So George Bush, he's a barbarian too. And blowing up people with high explosives dropped from the air could be looked at as even worse. In fact, look at America using drones to fight all over the world. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. Now back into Iraq again. Look at that from the point of view of the people on the ground. Look at that from the point of view of the survivors of the last drone massacre. That the Americans, oh yeah, I guess they got the capital to invest to create the technology. They can just kill us with remote control planes now. I mean, even if they're getting bombed by F-16s, there's a one in a zillion chance that, you know, I don't know, they'll just have an afterburner blowout and the pilot will have to eject, right? They have no anti-aircraft whatsoever. But at least when it's a fighter jet, there's a human in there. It's within the realm of conceivability that somehow they could ever fight back against him in any way, you know, John McCain style. But no, even if they did have anti-aircraft, even if an afterburner or a propeller blows out and a drone crashes, it's just a dead droid. It doesn't mean a damn thing. The Americans are safe back in New York State or in Nevada. or, you know, on a ship offshore or whatever, flying remote control planes, killing people. Now, I don't know exactly about what's civilized and what's barbarian. Watch me eat barbecue and you'll agree. But I know about sportsmanship, you know, because I have a dad. And he taught me about sportsmanship when I was a kid. It seems to me, and look, I know war is war. It's not supposed to be a fair fight. But aren't we kind of making a mockery of even the idea of any kind of fairness when we're simply flying fleets of remote-controlled planes around killing people? How badly do you think that radicalizes the people on the ground whose family are made to suffer in that way? I'll tell you a story I told you before. I'll tell you again, too. Spring of 2010, Faisal Shahzad tried to blow up Times Square. Thank goodness his bomb didn't work because he didn't have the training and the qualifications or maybe the ingredients to really make it go. But it's certainly conceivable that, he's in like a Nissan Pathfinder or something. You could fill one of those up big enough with a bomb to blow up Times Square. So for intents and purposes, it was a success. The fact that it smoldered is a relief. But his story, the story behind that, is that he was an American living the good life with a professional job, an advanced degree, professional job. I believe he was an engineer. He had a wife and a house and all this, living the American dream, better than a lot of us. Pakistani immigrant. He went home to Pakistan to visit his grandparents or his uncle or whatever. And he went home and he saw firsthand the results of an American drone strike. And I guess, you know, socialized a bit with the victims and the survivors. And then he signed up for the army on their side. And then they said, hey, don't fight in Afghanistan. Go back to America. Fight for us there. That was the first time the Taliban ever attacked the United States. And it was the Pakistani Taliban, not the Afghan Taliban. It was the Pakistani Taliban trained him and sent him here to do it. But he was happy to do it because of the direct results of America's drone war. The same kind of thing happens all the time. And, you know, by the way, too, as long as I'm talking about drone war and how unsportsmanlike it is and all of that, there's a great study called Life Under Drones about the men, women, and children of the SWAT Valley and the absolute terror that they live under there in the northwestern tribal territories of Pakistan. And I've said this before, too, but it's really worth your time, I think. It's a story about life under drones in Gaza in the Washington Post. And the whole first half of the damn article is, oh, poor, boo-hoo little Israel is surrounded by their helots that they occupy and enslave. Poor them, they have no choice. But anyway, I'm sure the editor probably wrote all of that because the actual story starts about halfway down. And it's about how if you're a Gazan, and especially if you're a Gazan kid, this is what it's like to live under drones with the constant buzzing of drones threatening to blow your body to tiny little smithereens with high explosives, as you've seen done in front of your very eyes to others over and over again. Every time a kid goes across the street to play at his friend's house, there's that buzz that may or may not blow his little body apart. Always, day in, day out, 365 days a year. And if ain't the drones, it's F-16s. Drive their tiny, helpless little minds crazy with fear. You might even say it's wrong, you know, if you wanted. But yeah, just type in children, Gaza, drones, Washington Post. And it's 2 or 3 years old. Great journalism. And again, that study was called Life Under Drones, about Pakistan and Afghanistan and those kids there. And anyway, I'm sorry, my computer blew up, so I wasn't able to cover Ukraine, Afghanistan, Libya, but we'll see you tomorrow.